Welcome to Kinfolk Lore. We're excited to share our love for some of our favorite stories. This season, we're taking a short break from fantasy shows to share with you our love for another genre.
That's right. We'll be talking about period pieces and historical dramas. We'll be getting into all of the high drama of royals, lords, and ladies. Our returning listeners will know that we're cousins who started a podcast because we love to talk about fantasy and sci-fi shows. In the past, we've covered His Dark Materials, The Witcher, Avatar The Last Airbender, Legend of Korra, and Lovecraft Country, and we've loved every moment of it. You should check out those episodes. But we've also loved to talk about and learn from historical dramas. We thought that it'd be a good idea to bring some of those conversations to our audience also.
We'll be covering some of the biggest period pieces in historical dramas, including Bridgerton in the Gilded Age, which we've already put out episodes on, The Crown. And last time, we talked about Bridgerton, and this week we'll be covering the first three seasons of the ITV PBS collaboration known as Downton Abbey.
Yeah, only three episodes, I mean, at a time. Seasons. What do you guys think
three
we
seasons.
Are? I mean, seriously, this is like a lot of shit. It's a lot.
I was born to podcast about Downton Abbey. This is me fulfilling my destiny.
Yes.
So I'm very excited. We love these stories for how they reflect our culture back at us and make us consider our history and highlight how people behaved during some of the most major transition periods of Western history. Because we're covering a lot of ground.
A shit ton of ground. Yeah.
There will be plenty of spoilers. So if you haven't seen the first three seasons of Downton Abbey, and if you haven't, I don't understand. What are you doing? What's going on?
Yeah.
Get on it and watch before you listen to this episode.
Yeah, it's going to be you dedicating hours of your life before you can listen to this. So please, speed through. Let's go, okay? Make a commitment. And if you're here for a killer, and I mean killer, one-night stand, and you get hyped about stories of revolutionaries finding love and members of the enemy side. Wait, is this Outlander? No, it's not. It's not. But you've come to the right place. Kinfolk Lore will have all your adult content. So check that off your box and let's go. So Downton Abbey is largely about the changing dynamics in British society during the early part of the 20th century. It focuses on the Crawley family, led by Robert and Cora Crawley, the Earl and the Countess of Grantham, who own a large estate in Yorkshire. The Granthams have three daughters, Lady Mary, Lady Edith, and Lady Sybil, but no son. So their estate will be left to Robert's closest male relative. And the story begins with the loss of that heir on the tragically fated voyage of the Titanic. So with the death of the heir and his son, a new young man enters the picture, a distant cousin from Manchester, Matthew. Seasons 1-3 of the show focus on the complicated love story of Lady Mary and Matthew and the changing landscape of England during the World War I era.
While focused on the story of this extremely elite family, Downton also very importantly gives the audience a view into the lives of the working class. Downstairs in the servants' hall of Downton Abbey, we meet the housekeeper, Mrs. Hughes, cook, Mrs. Patmore, butler, Mr. Carson, and many maids and footmen, including Anna, Daisy, Thomas, O'Brien, Ethel, Mr. Bates, etc.
They got a staff.
They got a lot of staff. Yeah. A lot of staff. I think at the beginning of this show, there's like four maids or five maids and three footmen. So it's a lot of folks. The stories of the servants are just as robust and often more compelling than that of the Crawley family. And the family upstairs and the staff downstairs are bonding together by the shared trauma of the war, the Spanish flu, and by the end of season three, four major character deaths. The footman William dies of his battle wounds during the war. Matthew's wartime fiance Lavinia Swire dies of the Spanish flu. Lady Sybil, may she forever rest in peace.
I still can't. It's just too
eventually
much.
Dies in childbirth. And in a shocking twist, Matthew, dies in a car accident after the birth of his son and heir. To say the first three seasons of the show are eventful is like a wild understatement.
Wild. And notice that we said major characters. So before all you fact checkers start typing in your keyboards, we know Pamuk took an L. We know this. Okay? We're going to get to him.
Mr. Pamuk is a minor character,
he's
y'all.
A minor character who took an L in like, I mean, he went out like, I mean, probably in the best possible circumstance you could go out with if you're going to go out like that. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to go out. So it's fine.
I would have included Mr. Pamuk as a character in a major character if he was in more than one episode. Like, it hurts my heart to consider Lavinia Swire a major character, but, you know, she's like a regular cast member in season two.
But Pamuk's memory lives
Pamuk
on.
Kamal Pamuk is literally in one episode.
But Pamuk's memory lives on. It's like Eddard Stark. He took an L in episode 9, but everyone feels his presence throughout the whole fucking run of show, okay? Like,
it's really true. It's really true. But so, you know, like, Patrick Crawley also comes back regularly in conversation and in passing.
Yeah.
And he wasn't even in the show. He died in episode 1.
It's true. It's true. He took an L off screen. Nobody even said that. Wow. Oh, man. So, I mean, let's talk about, you know, what we like about the show. And obviously, we love the show. You can see we're already talking about things we love. So what did you love, and what did you think could have been done better, maybe?
I mean, I think it's been made clear, those who know me, my brand with Downton Abbey is strong, I think.
Yeah.
I love this show. It is a show that I often put on in the background. I know these characters so very well that, like, it feels like sometimes I'm just listening to old friends talk or whatever. Mm-hmm. It is a show that's quite easy to watch. It's aesthetically pleasing.
Mm-hmm.
It's some of the cinematography and editing in the show is actually really beautiful. And it's not, even though, you know, there's a lot of drama, like, it doesn't feel like heavy, you know? You kind of know everything's going to be okay for the Crawleys.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
You kind of know. I just really enjoy, there's just like so many small things I could talk about, but I think at the end of the day, it comes down to, like, the relationships are really fun and complex. And because the show was on for so long,
mm-hmm.
they developed over time. So you get to see all of these people kind of grow, except for Lady Mary, because she basically always stays the same. But a lot of the other characters go through, like, incredible changes, especially the downstairs staff. And it's just, I think it's a fun show that also has, like, some really solid writing in it.
Yeah, agreed. I think that's what I love the most is one of the things that we've talked about this many times that TV has going for it outside of feature films is that they have time at their disposal. Mm-hmm. And so there's no rush to get there. And I think, like, that's what I feel a lot in Fellows' work is, like, it's not slow paced where you're just like, oh my God, can you go? But they're not in a rush to get to every topic. So it really gives you a chance to develop characters. And that really shines through in the fact of how much you fall in love with the downstairs crew. Like, you really find, like, you're not just invested in the Crawleys. You're invested in each of the characters that are downstairs as well. And their relationships to each other, and the relationships to the people upstairs, and the secrets that they hold, and the respect and that they have for each position, you know. So it's just really, really well done in that way. The pacing of it, I love that about it. I love also, and we can kind of transition a little bit into this. Is I love how they built the world, right? That's one of the things that we both love is to talk about is world building, and I love that, like, yes, we're in it with this family and with this household, but we're also gaining context, you know, right away at what else is happening in the world. The Titanic just sunk. We lost an heir. World events are impacting this family just as the family is trying to make their way and do different things in their lives. It's not just like all about their story, where a lot of times the lens in storytelling can sometimes, because you have protagonists, antagonists, it can feel like, you know, you know, that's why people who indulge in media so much can sometimes become super narcissistic. It's like, oh, you're seeing it through the eyes of the hero, and that's it. You actually are seeing it not only through the eyes of the heroes, you're seeing it through the eyes of the world, and I really appreciate that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that Fellows did a decent job of incorporating, like, the world events in believable ways, mm-hmm. right? So I think one of the things that you and I talked about when we were trying to figure out if the Gilded Age was perhaps like a Downton Abbey prequel,
mm-hmm.
Is like how would these stories fit together? And right there in the first episode, there is a question about the Astors mm-hmm. and being on the Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, there's right there, like, the major events of the day are linked to the story. Then the season two goes right into World War One.
Mm-hmm.
It ends with the Spanish flu. I mean, the ongoing changing dynamic in the world is just is like a character in itself. And right off the bat, that it brings up this tension between the various stratified classes, right? Mm-hmm. So they don't trust each other. You have the very wealthy and the peerage, and then you have the middle class, and then you have the working class, and like none of those groups really trust each other. And we learn that really early in the show, because as soon as Matthew is introduced, we start to get a lesson on like what it is that separates a Crawley family from everybody else.
No, they don't work. You know, they're people of leisure. They get up, they read their paper, they eat their dinner from their breakfast from their staff, and then what do they go about doing? What's the next thing on their agenda item? Looking over the books, the investments? I don't know. What's happening?
I mean, honestly, like, I'm hard-pressed to figure out how Cora spends her time in season one. Like, in season two, she runs the house as a house where is like sort of like a hospital.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a bit. But like, I don't understand. Like, what do they? I don't actually understand what they do all day.
What's a
like,
weekend? What's a weekend?
Literally. Like, there's in the first dinner that Matthew comes to, there's this question about what is the dowager says, what is a weekend? And she's not saying it as a joke. She's dead serious.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what the weekend is because she doesn't have a work week.
She skipped all those pop songs he put out. She's like, what's a weekend? You guys explain that to me. I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, man. Good on you. Yeah, I mean, and so no traditional work week, all the different things. And of course, here comes the patriarchy. Once again, rearing its ugly head.
They're going to be in every episode this season. We're going to talk about them all the time. You know, the patriarchy. And the patriarchal society is just going to be a constant character in these kinfolklore episodes because it's just.
Well, I mean, just to be fair, it's like because, it's so blatant. It's there. It's like the premise of this story, like we were even talking before we started today, we're like, you know, like Mary goes through all these loop-de-loops of like relationships and this and that, and she is the legitimate heir. I mean, listen, we're not only going to talk about this when we're talking about period pieces, we're going to end up talking about this when we cover House of the Dragon because this shit is prevalent in every one of these things, right? So it's it's super wild how you can just see how this line of succession, you know, how the peerage in this story and in multiple fantasy stories, this line of succession and it always going to a male heir really creates more problems for the characters and the families that are trying to uphold this standard than it helps, you know? And in this case, you know, by rights, this should be Lady Mary's inheritance.
Totally.
So, totally.
I mean, Mary, listen, I'm no fan of Lady Mary Crawley.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she is, in my opinion, she's the most unlikable character in this whole story.
She's no Sybil. I mean, let's just.
But she's also no Edith. Edith goes through a dramatic change. Mary is the same person in episode one that she is in the series finale.
And in the movies. Like, yeah, in the movies, too.
It's incredible. Yeah. Mary has no real character development that I can see. But that said, Mary should have been able to become the Countess in her own right. She should have been able to inherit this money and run the estate in her own right. She was able to do all those things essentially because of a bunch of like catastrophes, right? But like she will never, never be the Countess of Grantham. She'll never have that title. And she is able to sort of run things towards the end of the show in a way because she's doing it on behalf of her male child. So this is like just a very frustrating thing that comes up regularly in the first season. I mean, it's like a real point of contention between Robert and his daughter, his wife, and his mother are all like, what's wrong with you? Like, why won't you fight this? Mm-hmm. But he can't see any way of fighting it. And so that fight kind of just dies and Matthew is accepted as the heir.
Yeah. And I mean, he is accepted as the heir in that track. Like there's kind of like, okay, there's an L in some ways or it not really being, I mean, ultimately it doesn't matter that Matthew became the heir and except for, you know, what ends up happening. We'll talk about the deaths in a little bit. But then there's also Sybil and Gwen, right? Like, and how they, Sybil to me, and to you know what, we're not just going to give Sybil. I am going to go with what you just said. I'm going to say Sybil and Edith because Edith ends up, you know, becoming a publisher and running her own business and doing all these amazing things after, of course, we lose Sybil. But Sybil also starts out, I'm going to be a nurse in the war. I want to, like, you know, get my, I'm not going to just have my lady's maid, like, just not be able to get a job. Let's get her a job as a secretary. Let's go out to the protest rallies. So she's really active in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, obviously she also gets some support later on. From Branson, but she's like that anyway, like we spoke about offline. So what do you think about feminism in the 20th century, how it is portrayed by Sybil and Gwen?
I mean, I think that Gwen is a really good example, and later Daisy as well, is a really good example of just practical feminism. Hmm. Gwen, who I believe is a daughter of a farmer, got a good place, is a housemaid in a prestigious household, decides she doesn't want to be in service. She wants to learn a new skill. She takes it upon herself to learn that skill, and then she wants to find a job. Mm-hmm. Sybil, sort of, I think, vicariously living through Gwen, mm-hmm. helps her and does everything in her power to help Gwen go to interviews. In the end, she actually helps Gwen get the job because when the telephone is installed in the house, Sybil is very pushy in getting the guy who's installing the telephone to interview Gwen. So I think that Gwen's a great example of like the practical feminism that a lot of working class women experienced, because working class women didn't have the same influence and bully pulpit and resources where they could push back against the system in like a in a more radical way. They did it through, you know, trying to find little entry points into the system so that they could change their lives on an individual level. Sybil, I think, is interesting because if Sybil wasn't all the way in Yorkshire, mm-hmm. Sybil would have probably been a suffragette. Mm-hmm. She probably would have been one of the women during this period in England. The suffragettes were very different than American suffragettes. They'd been fighting actually for, I think, much longer for suffrage, and they did it in a much more radical way. And I think Sybil may have been one of those women if she had that opportunity. Many of those fights happened in big cities and, you know, Sybil lives in the country. But I think Sybil was the type of young woman who would have most definitely become more and more frustrated with her point of view, like with her situation as time passed. And so I think we're seeing like sort of the beginnings of in season one, like the beginnings of Sybil's challenging of the system that they live in. But she still lives mostly conventionally. I mean, we kind of talked about this with Eloise, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Bridgerton. Mm-hmm. She still kind of follows the rules. And then season two, she decides she doesn't want to sit around while all these people are dying. She wants to make herself useful. She becomes a nurse. By the end of season two, she has run off with the chauffeur, Branson. And by season three, she is a working nurse living in Dublin. You know, she's like living a whole different life. So I think that if eventually Sybil probably would have become more of a radical, mm-hmm. And would have been more representative of like the type of activist feminism that you tend to see. But I also think that that is sometimes can be a point of like privilege, like having the resources to put your body in harm's way, having the ability to, you know, travel to, like when Sybil and Branson get in trouble, which has nothing to do with feminism, it has mm-hmm. to do with Irish freedom. Her father goes and sees a cabinet minister and gets them out of trouble. I mean, yeah. How many people
could do that?
Gwen would have never had that opportunity. So I think that Gwen and Sybil are really interesting characters to kind of look at side by side.
I mean, do you think that because you mentioned earlier you were like, you know, she's kind of living vicariously through Gwen, Lady Sybil. Do you think that Sybil kind of like understood her privilege in that way? Or do you think that she was like not quite confident enough to step out of the confines of, you know, the peerage and all these other things? And she was kind of seeing whether it would work with Gwen to empower herself. Where do you land on that?
I think Sybil was developing her confidence in her beliefs. Mm. I think that she didn't have anyone to speak to about how she was feeling until Branson came along in terms of like what she believed. Their very first conversation that they have together is about women's rights. And no one else really talks to her about these things. I mean, like Edith is kind of vaguely interested, but not really. Mary is completely disinterested. I mean, the whole series, Mary's regularly like, I don't care about politics.
Yeah.
And I think that Cora, who is actually quite progressive, is still very conventional when it comes to her daughters. So I think that what we were seeing is Sybil kind of like developing her beliefs. Like, what did she believe? Like, she still wanted to come out, right, and be mm-hmm. presented at court. Mm-hmm. Right. So she didn't completely believe, she was looking forward to all those things. So it's not like she completely believed the whole system was flawed. But I think that over time, she was coming to see more that like she didn't feel like she fit into the system. I think a really good moment in the show, and they don't really give Cora Crawley that much to do, especially in the first few seasons. Mm-hmm. But one of the highlights, I think, that shows what kind of mother she was, is that when Sybil is going to run away with Branson and she's made it very clear there's nothing that will change her mind, Robert is basically like, this is not who she is. I don't want this life for her. She's going to throw away her whole life. And Cora retorts and says, maybe this is who she's always been and we failed to see her. Mm. And I think that that's like Sybil was just coming into herself. When I say she was living vicariously through Gwen, I think Gwen was getting to do things Sybil didn't see herself as having the ability to do. But as we, you know, can recall, both of them were doing it in secret.
Yeah.
You know, nobody knew that they were going on these interviews. Nobody knew that Gwen bought a typewriter and it was like the end of the world downstairs. So I just think that their relationship is really interesting. And then at the, you know, we'll talk more about seasons 4, 5, and 6 next time, but Gwen comes back.
Yeah.
Right? And we see how Gwen turned out after she left service. And I think that the show does a good job of showing like being a servant is a totally respectable, dignified position. But also there are other opportunities and people could, you know, Gwen actually went after some of those opportunities. So, I think that they're just kind of interesting. Same energy, right? I think they both believe in women's rights. Mm-hmm. I think that their way for pursuing that is a little bit different.
Can we just talk about we'll talk about other crossover casting, but can we, when I watched this, I binged both, and I'll mention this multiple times, I was binging both Game of Thrones and also Downton at the same time. Like, I was doing both. I was like, this was like my oh, nobody's gonna die show, which
except four people died.
Like, I was like, oh, fuck me. So then, but it was like kind of wild for me to see Ygritte on Game of Thrones, right, played by the same actress, Rose Leslie, and then see Gwen, right, like on Downton Abbey. And I was kind of like, wow, this is kind of wow. And it's weird because the actual actress, I just want to say, there's some crossover of multiple ways with this. Like, she grew up in Lickleyhead Castle, and her family is the 15th century. That's like the 15th century ancestral seat of her family. And she is from Clan Leslie, who is also connected to Clan Frasier, as we will get to in Outlander. So she is like a wildling in GOT. She's like, you know, getting out here, doing her thing and getting the jobs in becoming part of the working class, because, you know, you grew up in a castle. Maybe you didn't need to. I don't know. In Downton, maybe she was more of the upstairs crew in real life. And then in real life, she's actually related to the Frasier clan. Oh, my gosh. Like, listen, recognize a goat when you see one. Shout out Rose Leslie. Oh, man.
I always wondered, after I saw her as Ygritte, I always wondered if she was actually had auditioned to be like Lady Sybil or Lady Mary, you know?
Yeah.
She never really felt like she fit into the servant role particularly well. I think she did a good job of embodying it, but I always wondered which role did she actually audition for? I think this worked out for her, obviously, because she, you know, went over to Game of Thrones, played a really important pivotal character in that show, and then, you know, married Jon Snow. No big deal.
Yeah, you know, hooked up in a cave, you know, it was cool. It was good stuff. So let's talk about some of the things that are a little bizarre. We could start. Let's start with class prejudice, and then we'll talk about some things with Matthew. But so in the early episodes, it highlights various prejudices between the classes. So Lady Mary and the Dowager look down on Matthew, and we kind of talked about that a little bit. Matthew kind of shrugs it off and thinks that, you know, their insults are superfluous. Like, the way that they live is kind of like superfluous, actually, more that
he says that multiple, that's like a direct quote, he says it multiple times, I find this superfluous to the way that we live, him and his mother.
What about Mrs. Hughes regularly commenting on how highly they think of themselves? What do you think about that?
Mrs. Hughes, I just want to say, there's some characters on this show that I absolutely love and will stand until the end of time. Mrs. Hughes is one of them.
Yeah.
The shade she throws at Lady Mary is so beautiful. And the best part of it is that she throws it in front of Carson, who is like Lady Mary's surrogate godfather. Yeah. Like, nobody worships Lady Mary more than
Carson.
But she, you know, Mrs. Hughes is not she isn't afraid of acknowledging how ridiculous some of this stuff is. You know, she thinks it's absurd that, you know, nobody in the household can dress themselves without a servant. She makes multiple jokes about how Lady Mary thinks so highly of herself. She makes other jokes about people thinking that they're as grand as Lady Mary. I mean, there's a lot of like prejudice downstairs for the upstairs folks too. They don't think of them with a lot of compassion much of the time, which is also just understandable. If you see people every day and they can barely remember your name, how would you feel about them? You know, like Mrs. Hughes and Carson and Mrs. Patmore and all those higher ranking members of the downstairs staff, obviously the family knows their name, but there's like a point in the show where nobody knows Daisy's, no one upstairs knows Daisy's name. Mm. She's the scullery maid. When Gwen returns to Downton Abbey years later, they don't recognize her.
Yeah.
They literally don't recognize her.
Yeah.
The only one who recognizes her is Branson.
Yeah.
Because he was also a servant when she was. So I just think that the prejudice goes sort of always. I mean, when Branson is hired and he says he's interested in reading about politics and history, Lord Grantham is like shocked by that, mm-hmm. as if it's shocking that a person who is a chauffeur could have interests that are not just like cars. I mean, it's totally absurd. I will say this, and there's a lot of fans who would disagree with me, but when it comes down to treating the downstairs staff with dignity, like on a consistent basis, you can almost always count on the dowager to be the one to do it.
Hmm. As I think about it, you're right, but I wouldn't have thought about that at first. It's really wild because I would have thought no, but you're right. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, you can draw many, many, many examples of when the dowager treated people who, you know, were beneath the notice of like Mary and Edith with a lot of respect and compassion and tried to help them when she could.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think the perfect example is Mr. Moseley and his family.
Mm.
From the very beginning, she whenever she talks to him, she speaks to him with respect. She speaks of his father with a level of, you know, seeing him as a person of note in the village. Like she is a little bit set, in my opinion, a little bit set aside, even though she's the most haughty and stuck up of them all. She talks to the servants in a way that I think is much more deeply respectful than some of the other members of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually engages with them even when other members of the family don't. So when she sees Mrs. Hughes and Carson, she always greets them. There's an episode where Daisy is crying and she asks, you know, she comforts her. So there's, you know, I think the Dowager, even though she is sort of portrayed as like the most ridiculous character, I mean, she is the one who says, "What's a weekend?" She does actually see that the people who live in the village and who work for the family are worthy of the family's respect and loyalty.
Well, they did also let her win a freaking flower competition for like the duration of, like, you know, no matter how good they were or bad, she won every year, like, because they were just like, so she was like, she had them all in check.
Yeah, no, she totally flexed her privilege. I'm not saying that the Dowager didn't have many things that she could have improved upon. I just always find this thing about her to be very interesting.
No, I thought it was a great call out because I didn't think about it that way, but when you said it, I was like, man, it's true. Like 110% that she was aware of what was going on in many of the downstairs folks' life. You know what I mean? Which is like in a way that most of the upstairs crew was not. So that's
well. Let's just talk about William for a moment.
Yeah.
So William was a footman who was also Matthew's soldier servant. Which don't even get me started. But I can't even. But William's father, Mr. Mason, is a farmer on a neighboring estate. And the Dowager fought so hard at the end of William's life to first get him moved somewhere closer,
mm-hmm.
so that his father could visit him regularly. And secondly, to get William what he wanted on his deathbed, which was to marry Daisy.
Mm.
The way that she fought for him was really beautiful. She doesn't really know this boy.
Yeah.
You know, she did this because she thought that his father and him were getting the short end of the stick when William, in her opinion, was a hero. Yeah. So I just think that it's not always noted of her, but she is a person who often stands up for the working class members of the community more so than other folks. I mean, Mary has her moments, right? I don't want to say that Mary doesn't as well, but the Dowager definitely comes through regularly.
Speaking of standing up, there's some things that weren't standing up after Matthew's wartime injury.
Yo.
So what's the deal with his back injury? He had a bacchiotomy and then his penis did not work. It was a broken penis. What happened?
This is the most ridiculous. I'm a little bit speechless even now. This was the most ridiculous plot line it was so laughable because everybody knew that by the end of this season, Matthew's penis was going to work again.
Yeah, I actually watched this episode because, you know, my fiance puts it on in the background also. And I was walking by and the scene was on and the horror with like Lord Grantham pulling Mary to the side and the doctor and the whole thing and them letting them know that his penis may not work and how everyone looks so mortified. I was like, the guy's got a fucking broken back. This is not, that should be the top priority right now. What is going on? It's fucking
what
crazy.
What kills me is that Dr. Clarkson is like, yeah, he'll live a normal life. Lord Grantham, I need to speak to you. And then tells Lord Grantham, like, this very private thing.
Yeah, yeah.
maybe Matthew wasn't ready to share that part yet.
Because he won't have an heir. There won't be an heir to pass down the estate to. Because, again, the patriarchy.
it is the most absurd plot line. I laughed so hard the first time I saw. Like, I was like, are they serious? I will say this. Season 2 was not well liked when it first aired.
Yeah.
I actually think that season 2 ages quite well. But season 2 was, a lot of people had issue with this plot line. Like, I remember multiple websites making fun of it. It's kind of a bizarre plot line.
Yeah, and then like he's like, Lavinia, I'll never be able to bone. Go away from me. I cannot be the man that you signed up to be with. Forget this thing called love. There's boning. That will not happen. Get out of here. And she's like, no, what are you talking about, Matthew? Like, what is wrong with this fucking, yeah, this plot line is wild. And then
and then
you can't determine whether he's sending her away because of that or because he's like, I think I'd like Mary a little bit more. It's like back and forth for a little while in the way that it looks. And he kind of does start to develop feelings for Mary again.
Well, did he ever stop having feelings for Mary? Okay, we have to, before we talk about it, the next bizarre plot line, yeah. Cousin Patrick returned from the grave. I need to do a little bit of dragging of Mary Crawley for a moment.
Yeah.
Mary falls in love with Matthew, who is the heir to the estate, meaning that if she marries him, she will become the Countess of Grantham, which is all Mary's ever really wanted, right? At this point, like, this is what she wants. She wants to stay at Downton. She'll have a position of high rank. This is what Mary wants. But she also, as an aside, falls in love, genuinely, like, loves Matthew. Because her mother gets pregnant and it could possibly be a boy, not that it is a boy, could possibly be a boy, she leaves Matthew on red on his marriage proposal. It is the most trash. It is so trash. When Matthew left her, I couldn't even feel bad for her. I was like, you got to eat that L, Lady Mary, because that's wild.
Yeah.
Like, you left him on red until your mom has a miscarriage and now he's the heir again. Come on.
Wild. Super duper wild. Yeah, it's
come on. Mary does regular trash stuff all through the seasons, but to me this was like one of the worst. Well, this and how she behaved with Edith in season 6.
I was just about to go there. That was where I was going next. I was like, well, Eva, we won't talk about that till next week. Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty insane. I mean, So she doesn't really ever stop having the feelings. He never really stopped having the feelings. That's real. And it was always there, even though he ends up moving on with Lavinia. But
yeah, I believe you can love two people at once. Yeah. I think he cared deeply for Lavinia. He just didn't love Lavinia the way that he loved Mary. I think Mary and him had a connection, in a shared bond that was beyond anything he could have with Lavinia. But I think he would, if he married Lavinia, I'm sure they would have had an extremely loving, you know, and long lasting relationship. She seemed great in a lot of ways. And listen, I'm just going to at Danya right now. Don't come for me for saying Lavinia seems great.
Lavinia was not
bad. Our friend Danya is going to be like, what?
Listen, according, if it was the Viscount Bridgerton, he would just say she's of good stock. You know what I mean? Like, so. at least we're going deeper than that. Who else is stock is Imposter Patrick.
Oh,
but is
God.
He though? Is he of good stock or not? I don't know.
I have questions. Yeah. What was going on with Julian Fellowes during this season? Because first he has Mary out here trying to cover up the Mr. Pamuk thing with Jorah Mormont. And then he's got Matthew out here, you know, not being able to have sexy times.
Yeah.
And then, after all of that, then he has an imposter who comes back and says that he is Patrick Crawley.
Yeah.
In a plot line that I think is exactly one episode. And never gets resolved.
Never. Never.
It never gets resolved on screen. Now, those of us who are like epic Downton Abbey nerds will know that this Patrick Crawley was actually an imposter because he's referred to as an imposter in the script of the show.
Yeah, but they try to.
Show never resolves this issue.
Maybe he was thinking about going there and he was like, it's going to complicate things too much. Maybe he had that one thought of like, let me introduce Patrick coming back and making the love story between, you know, Mary and Matthew play out without the whole thing over their head about the estate. Like maybe that has nothing to do with it. They just fall in love without it. And then they find out afterwards he's an imposter. And maybe it just was like, there's too much complication. We don't have enough screen time. Let's cut that shit.
Yeah. And also like the Patrick returning would have given, if it was actually Patrick, would have given Edith an interesting plot line too. Cause maybe Edith becomes a Countess of Grantham.
Yeah.
You know, she always had a thing for Patrick.
Yep. 100%.
So I don't know. I don't know what to make of this. I think this was like a true season two has like some of the most bizarre plot lines, but then it also has like some truly endearing moments. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Bates get married in this. Mr. Bates and Anna, who later becomes Mrs. Bates, get married in this season. The whole drama about the Bateses, which I was talking to another one of her friends and I was like, I would like to avoid talking about the Bateses as much as possible, but here we are.
Yeah.
We can't really go through a whole, you know, episode talking about seasons 1 through 3 and not talk about Anna and Mr. Bates. So they fall in love in season 1, they get married in season 2. There's a lot of drama there as well, but there's some like really nice moments here, you know, to see the county kind of come together during the wartime, to see Downton Abbey turn into a convalescent home. Mm-hmm. Like there's some really good moments in season 2 that I really love. To see Edith go from being like a petty, you know, teenage girl to a really compassionate person who wants to help and do and, you know, contribute. I think there's a lot of good stuff that happens in season 2 and it sets the basis for great stuff. But then it's just like, what is going on with these bizarre plot lines?
Yeah, it's true. But I got to say, I do have an answer about Pamuk. I do have an answer about the Pamuk plot line that I stumbled across. Oddly enough, it's a true story about a diplomat. And I didn't know that. That Fellows actually said that he had a friend, right, who was from a major household, him and his wife, who essentially found a diary of an aunt who wrote about this particular scandal like this. And then in the diary of the husband of this aunt, they also were able to check it against the dates, and the dates actually read by the uncle, who had no idea about the death in the room and them sneaking the lady out. And the great grandfather of this person wrote inside his diary, "We had a great tragedy this weekend. The diplomat was found dead by his valet in bed." So basically, they got away with this whole thing. Like, it happened for real. There was really a death. They snuck this dude into his room and his quarters, and his valet found him, and nobody knew that it happened. And he literally wrote it based on what his friend's story was.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I just found this out, like, literally earlier today as I was preparing for the episode. And I was like, wow, this is really interesting. I was like, wow, this is a real story. So it was pretty, pretty, pretty profound to find that out today. So that's Mr. Pamuk. Pamuk actually was a Turkish diplomat, and Kemal Pamuk, may he rest in peace.
Poor guy. I mean, listen, I don't blame Lady Mary for what went down, because he's a good looking gentleman.
Yeah.
One night stand. What? I mean, she's a grown woman.
It's just the dying. Trolling energy of Netflix, that when you're watching this when you scroll and you hover on Netflix, the preview scene has Mary riding up on a horse talking about, "Oh, and where's Mr. Pamuk?" And you're like, oh my God, like literally, like y'all are wild out here. You know what I mean? That's the very thing in the preview. She rides up on a horse and asks the party where he was. He's not, you know, obviously we know what happened in that episode, but it's just funny. It's just funny stuff.
Yeah, it is funny. Netflix will no longer have Downton at the end of this month. So, folks, if you want to go rewatch it,
bring it in.
The time is now. But it is available on a number of other streaming services. So, no need to panic if you have access to any of those other services.
So, Lavinia dies. She dies of the Spanish flu. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about it for obvious reasons. There's a pandemic I just don't want to talk about it.
It's a rough episode. Yeah. I mean, the whole household gets sick.
Yeah.
Lavinia seems like she's doing fine.
Yeah.
And then she's the one who dies. Yeah. You know, it seems like she has a mild case. It's a rough episode. Listen, y'all.
Yeah.
It's tough. I watched it during the pandemic at the beginning, and I immediately regretted it. I was like, this is too much.
Oh, my gosh. She's like, yeah, that's too much. Too soon.
Lavinia had to go, right? Even though I do not care for Lady Mary very much, I still rooted for her and Matthew. We had to get rid of Lavinia. She had to go. There was no way else for her to go. So she had to die.
100%.
I'm sorry, but it's true.
The Spanish flu had to wipe her out. It's true. But who did not have to die? It was Lady Sybil.
Yeah.
Or Matthew. Listen, y'all, I'm just going to have a truth moment. As I said, I was binging both shows at the same time. Lady Sybil died. I turned away from Downton because I couldn't take it. I was like, I can't believe that Lady Sybil died. And the next day I said, well, let me keep on my Thrones watch. And I encountered a little thing called the Red Wedding.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that, like, 48 hours.
And I was like, holy shit, this is terrible. I don't even know what to do. I'm going to stop watching Thrones. Where do they even go from this? They killed everybody. I don't want to watch this show anymore. I watched everything and read everything. And I am, you know, this is my happy place. But I was like shook. And I said, well, I'll just finish Downton. And then Matthew fucking dies. I was inconsolable. Like, it was fucking terrible.
I remember. You were pacing around. Your fiance texted me. It was like, I don't know what to do.
I'm screaming at the television. No. No. He's not going to fucking die. This is a triumphant scene. This has to just end like this. And then he fucking died. From that scarred me. Like, every show now, I'm just like, okay, who's going? Like, I'm literally waiting for the other shoe to drop. You know what I mean? Like, but literally, it was
extremely shocking. I knew that Sybil was gonna die because, like, the show used to air in England first, and mm-hmm. so I had accidentally seen a spoiler that Sybil was going to die. So I went into that episode knowing, okay, like, this is gonna be sad. Matthew, complete shock. I was like, wait, did he, what's, wait, what?
Yeah.
Like, wait, how, is this the end of the show? I was completely stunned. Sybil saw it coming. Matthew never saw that coming. And yeah. still to this day, I'm a little bit shocked the show was able to continue because so much of the first three seasons was about Matthew and Mary.
Yeah. I didn't know. I was sitting there at one point like, okay, where do they go from here? Like, you know, on both shows, I just like, where do you go? And to the credit of the writing, to be completely honest, at least for the next couple seasons on Thrones, and then, you know, on Downton Abbey, it was like they built the story back up and got you reinvested in characters and made you feel like, okay, this was not, you know, they sucked you into believing one thing and then pushed you in a whole different direction. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's a real skill. I think that Downton had a little trouble in season four, and we'll talk a little bit more about that next week, but they did a much better job of replacing Sybil mm-hmm. than they did of replacing Matthew. I mean, really, they don't replace Matthew ever. There's like just a Matthew size hole in the show.
I agree.
But I think they did a good job of like introducing us to a new younger daughter. She's not actually their daughter, but Lady Rose gets introduced, and she's someone who we don't know very well, but is also a little bit of a rebel, but in a very different way than Sybil. She's
yeah, and in not... the season we get Lady Rose, and we get Lady Rose, and we get Lady and we get Mr. Gregson, right? We get Lady Rose and Mr. Gregson, who are both important to the show. You know what I mean? Like ultimately, mm-hmm. you know. So
yeah. Well, since we're talking about Rose and Gregson, we should take a moment to just talk about, since we've moved into season three, Edith getting jilted at the altar.
Yeah.
This was another really bizarre plot line, because it felt, to those of us who had started liking Lady Edith, this just felt like, why can't the show let her be great? Like, why can't Lady Edith just get something that she wants? Like, why does she always have to be like the downtrodden sister? And things just get worse for her as things go on. I mean, Mr. Gregson falls in love with her, but he's married.
Yeah.
He's married to a woman who is mentally unstable and institutionalized and doesn't know who he is. And the thing that's really upsetting about that is Matthew, who is almost always Edith's like ally, he also thinks the Gregson situation is like untenable. He's like, you can't, there's no way you can marry, you can't be with this guy.
Yeah. But
I mean, he doesn't say that to Edith. He tells Gregson, like, there's no hope for you. But it is like a truly bizarre plot line when Edith gets jilted by Anthony Strallon at the church. My guy showed up to the church and then left.
I mean, I kind of felt for Edith, but I was happy for her too, because Strallon was kind of whack. He didn't deserve Lady Edith.
He was terrible. I don't listen. As the Dowager said, any port in a storm. Listen, that relationship was not one to be desired. But
no,
I still, it was just, it's such a painful episode to watch. It's tough. But anyway.
No, I mean.
So we talked a little, we're in season three. We've talked a little bit about all of the, have we covered all the major deaths? We have, right?
Yeah, we have. I think so. I think we've covered every. Yeah,
yeah,
we've covered
we every talked major about death. Mr. Yeah. Kamook, William, Lavinia, Sybil, Matthew. We talked about how Rose and Mr. Gregson joined the cast. So I think it would be a good time to talk a little bit more about the crossover casting.
Well, we you know, again, first we'll start out with our queen, Ygritte, and then let's move on. All right, let's go. I mean, we got Richard Carlisle, who is
Ian Glenn, Jorah Mormont.
He's typecast. He's constantly man in waiting. He's constantly that guy.
It's a sad situation. We should talk about the like most epic crossover casting there can be, which is like, okay, so let's play 6 degrees of Mr. Carson here.
Yeah.
So Jim Carter, who plays Carson, is married to Imelda Staunton, who's also in the Downton Abbey movie, but mm-hmm. I'm mostly going to be talking about her roles on other places. So she plays Queen Elizabeth in the new season of The Crown, which hasn't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Other folks will know her from, you know, some media that we do not talk about anymore.
Nope.
Then their daughter, Bessie Carter, is Prudence Featherington.
What up? Shout out to the Featheringtons, the Lady Whistledown crew. You know, like, this is what it is.
So it's just like a total connection through like our whole period piece season is this family is very heavily represented. I mean, we won't be covering Imelda Staunton on The Crown because it won't have aired yet. But I just think it's fascinating that there's a connection to The Crown, Downton Abbey, and to Bridgerton.
Yeah, it's good stuff. I love that. I love that. There's so many good crossover like actors that are in all these different series, which are really, really, really dope. Like you have obviously one that is super famous. Let's go with like Shirley MacLaine. Wow.
I know.
It's kind of crazy.
How they got Shirley MacLaine, I don't know. But she plays Mrs. Levinson, Cora's mother.
Yeah. So
And Maria Kennedy Dole is a actress and a singer who is in so many things. I mean, she was in The Tudors as Queen Catherine, but in terms of the things that we've covered or will cover, she plays Mrs. Bates on Downton Abbey, but she also plays Aunt Jocasta on Outlander. She's also on a really amazing episode of Called the Midwife that I love. And she was also in Wheel of Time. I mean, she just like appears in so many things and she's amazing in all of them. And she's a beautiful singing voice as well.
I love her in The Tudors. And just because of time, because of what we're covering after our period piece season, we have not covered The Tudors. Who knows what the future holds, but man, I really love that show.
I mean, in my opinion, The Tudors was so influential to the next decade of television.
Yeah.
You kind of see The Tudors influencing all of these period piece shows, but you also see kind of Tudor influences in Game of Thrones as well. So good.
Yeah, I'm a super like just full disclosure. Andrew, you know this already, but I'll say this to our audience. I got so enamored with these period pieces that I was like, okay, what's the earliest made period piece about the monarchy, and where can we start? And I went to like the Vikings before. Like I did Vikings, then I did Uhtred, Son of Uhtred, Last Kingdom, did a little bit of that before England was England, you know, before it was the United Kingdom and all that, it had the different kingdoms. And then I went all the way through the White Queen, the White Princess. I did like Elizabeth. And in the middle of all of that was the Tudors. And I watched every episode of the Tudors until I got done with it. And then I was watching, you know, obviously all the stuff with the War of the Roses, and that really feeds into Game of Thrones. So, you know, this period piece life goes deep with us. Okay. Like we love this.
I remember when you were on your binge.
Yeah.
I remember that. I like at one point ran out of recommendations for you. I was like, I don't, you've surpassed me, sir. I don't know what to tell you. Cause I think you saw the White Queen and the White Princess before I did. And I was like,
shout out to both those series. I just hate that they switched the actors. Like, other than that, like, it's super phenomenal. But, like, Yeah, like I love both those, and I love the Spanish princess too. Like that one's good. That one's great too.
So. Shout out to Lady Edith because she's in that too.
Yep, 100%. She is. She crosses over in that. Yeah, that's what's up.
So I did want to just. I know we want to wrap up pretty soon, but I do want to like take a moment and talk about the biggest moments in the show.
Yeah,
and then let's rank our favorite, like the most, actually maybe not our favorites, but like the most influential.
Okay. So what do we got?
So the biggest moments that I have no particular order, they're not in order of how they happened. I just kind of jotted them down. Lady Sybil dying,
mm-hmm.
Matthew dying, Edith getting jolted at the altar, Sybil running away and marrying Branson,
mm.
Matthew proposing to Mary, Lavinia dying, Matthew being wounded and, you know, the mm-hmm. fallout from that, and Mr. Pamuk dying.
All right. We're going to throw, this is my top three. I'm going to throw Matthew being wounded in the war to the side. I think like, let's just get that out of here. That was like, I don't really care. William dies, man. It's hard to like throw that out, but it doesn't necessarily impact the show. It does impact the show long term, but not on the way that you would think. So I'm gonna go with Sybil marries Branson as number one. Oddly enough, mm-hmm. I think that because it changes Branson's trajectory, and he's going to still be a major player in the family for years and years to come. So I'm going with that. I'm going with Matthew proposes to Mary second.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to go. God, it's really tough because Lavinia dies and Matthew's death kind of play into. See, so like. All right, I'm going to commit. I'm going with Sybil and Branson. Sybil marries Branson. Matthew proposes to Mary for the second time, and then Matthew's death. The reason why I'm saying Matthew's death is because in his death, he has a will where he gives most of like all of the estate to Mary, and Branson, obviously being married to Sybil, will now manage things and help Mary think about the not only the small folk in the house or the downstairs, but also the whole town in a way that she may not have. So they both become key players in keeping the estate and the family alive based on those two actions.
I like your list. I'm going to counter it a little bit.
Okay.
I would say Matthew proposing to Mary, I think we're in agreement there.
Mm-hmm.
What the second time? most basically, like one of the most important parts of the series. If Matthew and Mary don't get married, like a lot of the show just doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Lavinia dying,
yeah,
because that's when Lavinia died. Lavinia saved Downton Abbey.
Yeah, that's true.
Her death.
Yeah. Good call.
Makes way for Matthew to inherit her father's fortune, which saves Downton Abbey in season three because the estate was about to go belly up. And then for my final thing, I think I'm going with Mr. Pamuk's death. Why? Because I think that Mr. Pamuk dying, even though earlier in this episode, we said that he's not a major character, and I still stand by that. But it changes the trajectory of Mary's life in so many ways. If Pamuk hasn't died, maybe Mary never even considers Matthew as a potential suitor. The fact that Mary goes to London and the story gets out largely because Edith snitched. And isn't able to get invitations and is kind of sidelined from society. That also is part of the reason that her and Matthew eventually get together. It's one of the reasons that she ends up with Richard Carlyle. It just kind of influences Mary's decision-making from this point forward. And so it also humbles her in ways that I think she hadn't been humbled before. Mm. So I think that it's largely influential on Mary's character. And since Mary is the star of the show, I'm gonna rank it as number three.
I like that. I actually like that. You know how I feel about Mr. Pamuk's death. So I like that. I put it up. I didn't want to go there, but I do like it because you're right. It does influence a lot. It influences a lot of the way she sees things, how she sees relationships. And it just occurs to me, is Edith in the Lady Whistledown of this show? She becomes a publisher. She like freaking like spills the beans about her sister.
I mean, Edith is horrible in season one. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Next time, I do want to spend a little bit of time talking more about like the various relationships. We just didn't have time today, but like Mr. Pamuk also is one of the reasons I think Edith and Mary could never fully recover. You know, they never really could make amends after this, and Edith was in the wrong.
She was kind of like feeling she felt a little bit, you know, slighted by her sister, and so she went for the jugular. I agree. Yeah,
100%. Like Edith was. I think Edith is like 19 when this happened. It was a very immature thing to do. And I think it's one of the things that Edith would say with hindsight was pretty treacherous, and she regretted doing it. That said, it's a hard thing to come back from, you know? Like, you took this horrible thing that you knew would ruin your sister and possibly throw the entire family into scandal, and you shared it with a complete stranger.
Especially with just what we know about the ton, and we know about the 400 in America, we know that they scandal is like, you know, it's like what everyone's on everyone's lips, at their morning tea. You know what I mean? Like whether it's English breakfast tea or it's coffee, because we don't drink tea over here. That it's fine. I do want to at some point also maybe if we have time next week. I know there's a lot to get to in the other seasons. But I definitely do want to talk about Ada and Edith's comparisons or Gilded Age characters and comparisons to the characters here. And I think we've talked about a little bit in the Gilded Age, but I kind of see some crossover there too. And maybe we'll talk about a little bit more about, you know, our headcanon about this being a prequel, but also just how the characters kind of like match up between the two households.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea. So we'll make some time for that next week. Honestly, the last three seasons of this show are not as nearly as eventful. Mm-hmm. Some interesting stuff happens, but a lot of, especially season six, is just tying up loose ends. A lot of what we see is just the fallout from Matthew and Sybil's deaths, which are horrible and take a long time for the family to kind of heal from. But I think we can make time to talk about these various things. So we'll definitely make a point to do that next week.
Awesome. Well, that will do it for us. We hope that you've enjoyed our first part of our coverage of Downton Abbey. We'll be back next week to cover our second half, like here of Downton Abbey. And we hope you enjoy your week. Follow us at all of the normal social places. Kin Folklore Pod on Twitter, Kin Folklore Pod on Instagram. You can email us at kinfolklore@gmail.com and join our Facebook group so we can converse about all these multiple topics. Have a good one.
Also, don't forget the Downton Abbey movie is coming out.
Oh, yeah.
In just a couple of days.
Just a couple of days.
Yeah, the second movie.
So watch the first movie, then watch the second movie. That's amazing. That's good.
All right. Bye, everyone. We'll see you next week.